Now, I wonder if you remember last Sunday evening I introduced to you to three caricatures, I suppose you could call them, people who all believed that they had faith. First of all, there was Joe, or Holy Joe, as his friends called him. For him, faith means going to church every Sunday and reciting the creed. I believe. Then there was Charlie, cheerful Charlie. For him, faith meant always looking on the bright side, being an optimist, being a positive thinker. And then there was Simon, simple Simon. For him, faith basically meant being gullible. He believed everything he was told. Flying saucers, Martians, fairies at the bottom of the garden. Anything anybody told him about, he believed it. We tried to see last week that that really wasn't what the Bible means by faith at all. So we looked in Hebrews chapter 11 at what the writer of this great letter has to teach us about faith. Well, now this week, as we come to our next great text, Hebrews 12 verse 2, I want to introduce you to another caricature of faith. Jack, or Idle Jack, as his friends call him. His idea of faith could all be summed up in one word: relax. You see, Jack went to an evangelistic meeting one night, and the evangelist there told him some very wonderful things. He told him, well, if he had problems, if he had anxieties, if he had obstacles in his life, things he wanted to achieve that he wasn't sure he was going to achieve, the remedy was quite simple. All he had to do was believe. Believe in Christ and all his problems would go away. Was he worried about passing exams? Don't worry. Trust the Lord. Did he have problems with his girlfriend? Don't worry about it. Just trust the Lord. Did he have a tendency to drink too much? Don't worry about it. Just trust the Lord. All his problems, all his habits, all his difficulties, all his unfulfilled ambitions, they would all be his. And all he had to do was believe. What was believing? Well, this evangelist had a marvelous illustration to explain to Jack exactly what believing was. He said, look, a chair. You know what a chair is, don't you? Well, all you've got to do to prove that a chair is really a chair and will hold you up is sit in it. That's what believing is. Believing is just sitting down on what Jesus has done for you. Believing in it. Marvellous, thought Jack. Best thing I've ever heard. He sat down on that chair that night and he hasn't got up since. That's why his friends call him Idle Jack. His favourite texts are, rest in the Lord. Wait patiently for him. The motto he has on his wall is, don't try, just trust. That's Jack's philosophy of faith. And I have to tell you, it's an idea of faith which is far more common than Holy Joe's, or Simple Simon's, or Cheerful Charlie's. At least in churches like this one. See, the trouble is there's an element of truth in it. Strong element of truth. It's perfectly true that Jesus can solve people's problems in wonderful ways. Broken marriages have been healed. Alcoholics have been delivered from their addiction. Depression and anxiety have been lifted as people have trusted Christ. The trouble is with that chair analogy. It makes it sound, you see, as if following Christ, being a Christian, is just too easy, too effortless. It makes Pilgrim's Progress sound as if it's a long, lazy stroll through Beulah Land, doesn't it? Where Bunyan put all those bits in about the Slough of Despond and the hill difficulty and Doubting Castle and so on. No, for the Idle Jacks of this world, there's none of that. Christianity is basically a matter of relaxing, letting Jesus do it all for you. Now, I would suggest tonight that that's a misrepresentation of what the Bible means by the life of faith. In fact, Jesus and the apostles made it clear again and again and again. It is through many hardships we enter the kingdom. But there is a struggle, there is effort involved in being a Christian, and we mustn't minimize it. And nowhere is that made clearer in the Bible than in the great text that we're going to look at tonight. Hebrews chapter 12 and the first couple of verses. Since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, says our text, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. A race, then, that's the figure, that's the metaphor this writer selects to describe the normal Christian life, the life of faith. He says it's not a matter of sitting down in a chair. It's much more energetic than that, I'm afraid. It's not a spectator sport in which we all relax in the grandstand and watch Jesus solve all our problems for us. That's completely mistaken. Its victories are not won independent of our efforts, he says. No, we find success in the Christian life. We gain the prize of the Christian life only through active endeavor, through running the race. That's what it's all about. Remember, his first readers were people very familiar with Greek culture. So this picture of running a race was one that would be very familiar with them. The Olympic Games got their inspiration from the contest that used to be held in on Mount Olympus in ancient Greece. And so if this writer wanted to a way of challenging his first audience to put more effort into their Christian lives, he couldn't have chosen a better metaphor, could he? And they did need it, because quite a few of them, it seems, are in danger of slipping back into a much more comfortable, less demanding kind of idea of what Christianity was about. This evening, I just want you to notice three things implicit in this great text: the team, the discipline, and the captain. Let's start in the middle with the discipline. Let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Now, you know as well as I do, when you want to run a race, you have to strip off. You have to get out of your suit, out of your heavy shoes, and put on something that's less encumbrance. Of course, Greek athletes actually competed naked, so they took that to extremes. It may be that's what's in the writer's mind when he says, let's throw off everything that hinders. Get rid of all the clothes that would stop us running fast. But equally, the words he used could have reference to something else. You know again, as well as I do, that you not only strip off when you're getting ready for a race, you also try and lose a bit of weight. A good athlete can't afford any surplus fat. He knows he's got to be trim, 100% muscle, if he's going to do his very best. And that could very well be the reference, rather than clothes, that the writer's referring to here. He's saying the Christian must be free of all unnecessary hindrance, whether it be clothes or a surplus carbohydrate. He has to compete in the race in a way that's not encumbered in anything. What sort of things do you think he might have been thinking of practically when he talks about hindrances, things that can slow the Christian down, stop him running the race of faith as he should? He could be thinking about possessions. One of the things that his first hearers had to contend with was dispossession of their property. One of the things that happened to you in the Roman Empire, if you were a Christian, you had your property seized. That could be very discouraging. You had to sit pretty loose to your possessions if you were going to be a Christian in the first century. Maybe that's one of the things that could encumber somebody then. Stop them running the race. Jesus once told a wealthy scribe who wanted to follow him, foxes have got holes, birds of the air have got their nests. The Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Born in a manger, died on a cross, He never promised his disciples anything better than that. Sell what you have and give to the poor, he told another rich man once. Come follow me. There are many, I guess, who puff and pant, defeated and ashamed in their Christian lives, because really and truly they've grown fat on the carbohydrate of their affluence, their self-indulgence. They haven't learned to sit loose to their possessions. Fear of losing them gets in their way. Or maybe the writer's thinking about emotional relationships. They can be an encumbrance too, can't they? One of the things this church that he's writing to, I'm without any doubt, had to put up with, was pressure from family and friends. They'd become Christians. They were in danger of persecution. They were in danger of throwing away the family's livelihood. You must give it up, said their family and friends. You mustn't go on with this Christianity lark. It's too dangerous. Think of us. Can be quite often like that, one way or another. There was a man who came to Jesus wanting to follow him. He said to Jesus, let me go back and see my father, gets a decent burial, then I'll come and follow you. Jesus wouldn't have it. No, he said, I must come first, before your father even. Hard words, aren't they? But necessary, because emotional entanglements can limit us in running the race. I'm quite sure the Lord Jesus Christ loved his family very dearly, but his mission caused immense controversy amongst his brothers and sisters, between his parents and him. I'm quite sure he was a man with passions and desires like any other man, but he never married, you know. And we can't say he hasn't prepared us for the fact that we may have to face similar sacrifices within our circle of emotional relationships. We mustn't allow them to get in the way. A Christian race involves the shedding of all hindrances so that we can run our best. Yes, and the sacrifice, the discipline involved, doesn't stop there. There's something else too, isn't there? The sin that so easily entangles us. He's not talking here about neutral things that simply slow us down, is he? He's referring here actually to moral habits and failures of life that have the power to trip us up, bring us to a full stop, not just slow us down. Habits may be that we haven't got the courage to break, temptations that we surrender to without ever a fight. The battle always begins in the mind, doesn't it? We all know that. Resentful thoughts may be that we nurse and we cherish till one day they just ignite into a flame of anger. Lustful thoughts may be enjoyed and rehearsed privately till one day they just explode into explicit acts of sexual immorality. Jealous thoughts, proud thoughts, greedy thoughts, all kinds of impure and vicious ideas enter our imaginations every day, don't they? And the trouble is, instead of shrugging them off, we embrace them and find soon that our Christian race has run into a bramble patch. They're entangling our feet, they're tripping us up, these sins. It's an obstacle race, you see. You have to be nimble-footed to run this race. You mustn't let sin entangle your feet, he says. A discipline involved. And if you notice carefully, the discipline doesn't stop there either. There's the cost and sacrifice of getting rid of the hindrances. There's the nimble-footedness that's necessary to evade the sin that could trip us up. Something too is needed. Endurance. Let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Because you see, this is not a sprint that you can master with a single burst of energy. This is a marathon. The word used here for race is the word from which we get our English word agony. It means a struggle. It has implicit in a great deal of long-term, fortitude and determination. I think it's true, you know, that there are quite a few people who begin the Christian race, all right. They start it with enthusiasm, even. But then the novelty wears off. There is a novelty value in becoming a Christian, isn't there? The novelty wears off, and because they have no stamina, they get easily distracted, easily tired. You must have heard that story, the famous fable of the hare and the tortoise. Most pastors, I think, would tend to agree that it has a spiritual parable in many Christian lives. The fast starters are often the ones that burn out before the finishing tape. It's the steady plodders who win in the end. Perseverance, then, that's the third element in this discipline that's required of us if we're going to stick the pace, run the race, and finish it. We can be handicapped by all kinds of things, exhausted by the demands upon our courage and our resolution, tripped up by sin. All kinds of things can happen to us which will make us want to give up. As the writer puts it in verse 3, grow weary and lose heart. That's what the people he was writing to were in danger of doing because of the pressures on them. And now he says, this is not a speed trial, this is an endurance test, this Christian race. You want to run it with perseverance. And yet he says, if you're a real Christian, you've got no choice about it. It's an unavoidable race, you see. Run with perseverance the race marked out for us. There isn't an alternative, easier route. Now you will find those who pretend to have found one. Some spiritual diversion or other that is guaranteed to rid the Christian race of all its torture and hardship. There are countless books which I'm afraid gain altogether too much prominence on bookshelves in some Christian bookshops, offering this kind of a spiritual detour to the easy, effortless Christian life. Some special blessing guaranteed to make your life effortlessly victorious. Well, this writer in the Bible, he offers us no such shortcut to heaven. We must expect the obstacles. We must expect the difficulties. We must expect the trials. We must wrestle with the sin. We must struggle with the things that want to hinder us. We must grit our teeth for the perseverance. When the going is soft and untroubled, that's when you need to be worried. Because authentic Christianity finds its spiritual muscles tested to the limit. If we don't find our spiritual muscles are being stretched like that, strained like that, if we don't find there's something demanding about being a Christian, then I wonder whether we really are on the racetrack. Maybe like Idle Jack, we're trying to snooze in the grandstand. That's the first thing then to note, the discipline involved in this Christian race. It's no effortless amble. It's hard work. Well, we need encouragements then, don't we? I mean, no one but a fool engages in a race unless there's some strong incentive. I know when I was at school we had to run races, and one of the major reasons that I spent more time walking than running was that I wasn't particularly persuaded there was much to gain by getting there first. I mean, if the PE master had offered a fiver to the boy who got there first, I would put in a great deal more energy. What incentives, what encouragements does the writer offer to us in this passage to get on with this grueling race? Well, they come in two shapes. The team, the captain. Let's look at the team first. Since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, well, here's an encouragement. This is a team race. We're not just plodding on our own individual little way. There are colleagues in this race. There are even veterans who have run the race before. This great cloud of witnesses. Now, he's talking here, of course, about the catalogue of fame that has preceded these verses in chapter 11. How he recited all those great heroes of the Old Testament, Noah and Abraham and Moses. These were great men of faith. No more than that, he says. They were witnesses, a great cloud of witnesses who surround us as we run the race. Now, what could he mean by that? Well, of course, a witness is first of all a person who confirms the facts of a case, isn't he? He says such a thing is true. And perhaps that's what he means when he says these great men of the past are witnesses. They join in common testimony to the fact that faith works, that it's real. To those invisible things that faith latches onto, the invisible things, the spiritual things, the eternal things, the things you can't see with your physical eyesight, but which you can only perceive with this sixth sense of faith. These things are not imaginary, they're not illusory. They really are there. These men witness to that. Now, all of us in our Christian lives at times experience doubt. We wonder whether this thing we've committed ourselves to is real, or whether, you know, we just dreamed it up, whether we just went balmy for a little while when we became Christians. All of us have nagging feelings like that every now and again on our Christian pathway, especially when we're feeling demoralized, when the rigors of battle are getting us down a bit. But it's a good therapy at times like that to dwell on the fact that if Christianity is a delusion, it's certainly not limited to just me. To the faith I confess, it has been shared by countless millions, not only of my contemporaries, but of my ancestors. We don't run the race alone, though sometimes we may feel isolated. Others have run the race before us, they are the veterans, and some are running it with us now, they are our colleagues. We're surrounded by those who witness to the same faith that we've discovered. That spurs us on, you see. That's an encouragement in times when our feet begin to drag. We're surrounded by the witnesses. But there may be something else too involved in this word witness. For witness is not only a person who gives testimony to the facts of a case, a witness is also a person who observes with his own eyes and passes comment. Now, it could be, you see, that it's not the invisible things of faith which these heroes of the past are looking at, as he depicts them here in verse 1. It could be that they're looking at us, the ones who are still running. This word surrounded, maybe he's got in mind the amphitheatre of the stadium. If you've ever been to Greece and seen what an athletic stadium was like, you'll know how the tiered seats surrounded the field where the events were held. And all the spectators stood on these ranks, like Wembley Stadium today, to look at things that were going on the field below them. Maybe that's what's behind this word. Surrounded. We're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses. They're watching us running the race. It's not just a team race. It's a relay race. They've done their leg. They've finished it. And now these other members of the team are there in the grandstand looking down at us from their completed position of having finished their leg of the race, and they're cheering us on. They want us to see us reach the tape. That's a fairly unusual thought in the Bible. We don't normally think much about whether people who've died and have passed into glory are actually aware of what's going on in this world or not, and some of you may have different opinions about that. But it's not impossible that's what the writer's talking about. We certainly know, as Tim was reminding us this morning, that Moses and Elijah came to talk to Jesus about what he was going to do. They seemed to be aware of what was going on planet Earth, as God worked out his plans in history. And it's quite an encouraging thought, isn't it? This thought of the communion of the saints, the men of faith who finished the course and gained their victor's crown are still maintaining a lively interest in our affairs. They want to see the last runner in home. Every bit as much as we want to win the race, they want us to win it too. Because, as he says, only together with us will the perfection that they were longing for come to pass. But there's a third aspect to this word witnesses, and I must say, the more I think about it, the more I have a suspicion that this is the sense in which the writer here principally is meaning it, or you must judge for yourself. Perhaps it becomes more easy to understand this shade of meaning if I just tell you that word witness in the original language is the same word that we have in English for the word martyr. quite early in the church's life. Indeed, the roots of it go back into the period of the Maccabees, before 150 years before Christ. This word witness began to take on this extra shade of meaning. It began to mean somebody who died for their faith, a martyr, a person who suffered because they were a believer and were faithful to God. And if you think about it, many of these heroes of the faith, whom the writer has just been enumerating, were martyrs in that sense. They suffered or even died for their faith. Some were stoned, some were sawn in two, they were put to death by the sword, they went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destituted, persecuted, mistreated. Many of these he's just listed were a catalogue of martyrs. We are surrounded by so great a cloud of martyrs, he says, then let us run the race. Now, of course, martyrdom is something we've heard a bit about in connection with Iran, haven't we, recently? These people who drive about on high-speed boats crammed with explosive and ram other ships. They want to call themselves martyrs. Operation Martyrdom, they advertised, didn't they? Important for us to say that that's no Christian definition of martyr. In Christian terms, what they're talking about is fanaticism, not martyrdom. A martyr isn't a person who seeks to do violence to others, even if it costs him his life. He's not a kamikaze pilot. That's fanaticism. No, a Christian martyr is a witness. A person who will not abandon their witness, even if they have to die for it. Strange thing is that when people are prepared to witness with that kind of courage, instead of deterring others in their team, the effect is to fire others with an even greater zeal. Isn't that true? When a man dies for a cause, it puts a moral responsibility on those who remain alive to ensure that he didn't die for nothing. There's a powerful logic then in these last words, seeing we are surrounded by such a great cloud of martyrs. Let us run the race. See, we're not on our own. It's not an individualistic little race that God has set just you on your own to get from A to B. You're part of a team, and the team depends on you. Some members of the team who've gone before have paid a great cost to get the baton to your hand. And are you going to throw it away? Are you going to drag your feet? When other members of the team have done so much to get that baton into your hand, when they're relying on you so much to finish your leg of the race, maybe even cheering you on from the grandstand, surrounding you, watching you, keen, egging you on. You think of the Christian life that way, you see. It's a great incentive to run the race. It's a pity few of us really read much church history. Much neglected study of Christians today, really, isn't it? Because so much of our incentive comes from understanding our heritage. The saints who've gone before us and who rely on us to keep the race going. As I say, I'm pretty convinced that that martyr sense of the word witness is fairly prominent in our writer's mind here. And one of the things that convinces me of that is that he links this great cloud of witnesses so explicitly with one who you could argue was the most outstanding martyr of all, who's not just a member of the team, the captain of the team. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Now tell me, what right have we got to expect our journey to heaven to be smoother or more comfortable than Jesus's? How can we laze in our hammock like idle Jack when Jesus had to hang on a cross? There is a subtle ambiguity, you know, in that word, for the joy set before him. In English, the word for is ambiguous. It can mean for the sake of, like you say, I play tennis for pleasure, for the sake of pleasure. Or for can also mean in exchange for, like give me £5 for this book. And the preposition that's used here has that same ambiguity in it in Greek. It could mean for the sake of, for the sake of the joy set before him he endured the cross, and most commentators take it that way. But equally it could mean who in exchange for the joy set before him endured the cross. And I have a suspicion that may be precisely what this writer's thinking of. He wants us to see the sacrifice that Jesus had to make, the entanglements that he had to shed in order to run his race, the sacrifice, the discipline, the cost to him, instead of the joy of heaven. He had to endure the cross. That's what the race is all about. Sure, the way to that tape is hard, but it was hard for him. We know the pressure of the world, so did he. What the writer calls the opposition of sinful men. We know the pressure of temptation, so did he. What he calls the struggle against sin in verse 4. Jesus battled with exactly the same pressures as we do. And he's shown us the way. That's why he calls him the author and perfecter of our faith. He's the trailblazer. He's the pace setter. From start to finish, we must run the race he's already completed. Author and perfecter of faith. Follow me, he says. Take up your cross and follow me. Heaven is higher than the earth. And to get there means an uphill climb against the opposition of sinful men. A struggle against sin. Of course, there is a place that is lower than the earth. You can get there much more easily. You can slide there all the way on your backside if you want, just propelled by the gravity of your own sinful, fallen nature. Just dragged along by the company of a hell-bound world. It's easy, you see, to get there. Every day we live, we choose between climbing up or sliding down. Between fighting the enemy or surrendering to him. Of drifting with the tide or struggling against it. Of running the race or idling in our hammock. And when we make that choice, we choose our destiny. Jesus said so. The way is easy, he said, easy and broad, that leads to destruction. The way is hard and narrow, that leads to life. Jesus walked the narrow and difficult way. And the writer encourages us to fix our eyes on him. Make him the focus of your life. Don't be distracted, don't be deterred, don't let sin clog your feet. Center your affection and ambitions around him, he says. Because it's worth it. There is a prize to this race. He sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. And one day he intends to share that throne and the glory of it with those who, like him, finish the race. So what are you complaining about? So being a Christian is difficult. So was his path. He endured it. So you find others making fun of you because you become a Christian. They mocked him and he scorned the shame. It's running a race, you see. And let's face it, they haven't put you or me on a cross yet, have they? You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood, he says. You haven't had it as hard as the martyrs or as the captain yet. How dare we complain then that the race is tiring? Fix your eyes on Jesus. Maybe there are some folk here who have been Christians a long while. But maybe for one reason or another, like Idle Jack, You've been spending an awful lot of time in the spiritual hammock, trying to be a spectator rather than a participant in the Christian race. An awful lot of Christians like that, I fear. They're happy to be a Christian, happy to come along to church, so long as it's not too demanding, you see. Well, I have to tell you, if you're going to make progress as a Christian, if you're going to reach the goal, the prize, you're going to have to face the fact that running the race is not comfortable. You're going to have to stop coming to church just to be entertained. You're going to have to start rolling up your sleeves and getting on with some work. Very easy in a church like this one at Eden to sit and sit and sit, lapping up all the good teaching, enjoying the hymns, meeting the people, finding good friendships, social life, and so on, but not really doing anything, not really putting in any effort, not really being involved, not facing any discipline. It's very easy. It won't do. Let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. That's the text for you tonight. But equally, maybe there's somebody here tonight who's not a Christian at all. But like some of the Christians, you've been sitting around for a long while. Sitting on these chairs maybe, or others like them in other churches, listening to the Christian message. Like many Christians, you quite enjoy church. Quite entertaining. Good sermons, quite an interesting thing to listen to, and you can enjoy the music. And of course there's the friends, aren't there? I mean, it's a good place to meet nice girls and boys, a church. But you're not a Christian. And the reason you're not a Christian really is that you've just been sitting and sitting and sitting. And when someone asks you why you're not a Christian, you'll say something like, well, it's never happened to me. You know, I'm waiting for something to happen. Like some electric spiritual bolt from the blue to descend one day on you. Is that what it is? See, faith isn't like that. You don't discover faith by sitting. There's nothing sedentary about faith. Faith is a race. You will start to discover faith when you stop sitting and start doing. Start praying. Start reading the Bible every day and doing what it says. Start talking to other people about Christian things. You'll be amazed how quickly your own convictions will begin to clarify once you stop sitting and waiting for something to happen to you and realize that the Christian faith involves action on your part. It involves a decision. It involves you getting up and starting to run. Nobody ever discovered faith lolling in a hammock. Faith is a challenge to get moving. Let's pray together.